Lecture 31, Industrial Rivalry, 1870 to 1914.
While Europe was adjusting to the rise of Germany and acquiring new territories overseas between 1870 and 1914, it was also experiencing what some historians have called the Second Industrial Revolution. Now, one measure of the Second Revolution is its new sources of fuel and energy. Oil had been important for much of the 19th century as a source of artificial light, but by the end of the century, it was being refined into gasoline for internal combustion engines, first invented by Carl Benz in 1885. In 1891, Armand Peugeot manufactured the first automobile in Europe. These only became common after about 1900. Electricity was cleaner and cheap, but necessitated the construction of power plants and the formation of great financial combines to bring it to the city and beyond. After 1880, these fuels would make possible a cornucopia of new inventions. Let's just take communications. By mid-century, telegraphy had revolutionized long-distance communication. But in 1876, Alexander Graham Bell invents the telephone in America. Thomas Edison, working out of a lab in New Jersey, invented the electric stock ticker in 1869, the phonograph in 1877, the electric light in 1879. In 1882, he established the first commercial power generating stations at Holborn Viaduct in London and at Pearl Street, New York. But most European houses didn't electrify until after 1900. In 1895, Guglielmo Marconi perfected the use of radio waves for communication. Motion pictures got moving when, in 1888, British photographer Edward Muybridge demonstrated to Edison how sequential photography could capture movement. By 1889, Edison had invented the kinetoscope, a primitive motion picture camera. Effective typewriters appeared by the 1880s. Now, in the meantime, free trade, loose banking and commercial laws, and even greater, ever greater amounts of liquid capital made possible multinational corporations like Standard Oil, Woolworths, Armstrong Whitworth, Singer, which expanded to Europe. Westinghouse also expanded to Europe. In Germany, cartels. In the United States, trusts controlled related businesses and established monopolies. Total productivity during this period of time, 1870 to 1914, trebled. One example of even more than that is European steel production. 500,000 tons in 1870 became 11 million tons by 1890. But in the short run, all of this productivity did not translate into economic stability. Beginning with a massive worldwide depression in 1873, this period saw periodic boom and bust cycles. These were mainly due to overproduction. For a century, factory owners and economists had focused on producing ever greater amounts of goods more cheaply. Few understood that you actually had to pay the workers well enough to be able to afford to buy the goods. And so there were gluts. And during gluts, prices fell, then wages fell, and unemployment rose. This sometimes resulted in bitter strikes. The most famous example is perhaps the 1888 London Match Girls strike. Its very name suggests the sort of poignancy of this event. But in the long run, for the middle class especially, the Second Industrial Revolution made people's lives better. Thanks to the Industrial and the Agricultural Revolution and increasing sophistication in transportation and distribution networks, agriculture was further revolutionized by mechanical reapers and threshers. Refrigeration and rail transport revolutionized diet and health by bringing fresh food to the cities. By 1850, famine was a thing of the past in developed countries. Now, as we've seen, it still devastated the Irish population between 1847 and 1851. This, plus migration from the potato famine, sent the Irish population tumbling. 8.1 million in 1841 were reduced to 4.4 million by 1911. Famine also attacked Russia in 1891. So on the two ends of Europe, we still face relatively undeveloped economies and transportation networks. As we've seen, advances in medicine, hygiene, and sanitation also made inroads into cholera, tuberculosis, smallpox, typhus, and typhoid, leading to longer lifespans. Life expectancy rose in Europe from perhaps 40 at mid-century to the late 40s by 1900. During the 19th century, the population of Europe grew from 190 million to 423 million. Millions of European immigrants further swelled the populations of North and South America, Australia, New Zealand, and South Africa. 63% of the migrants went to the USA. 47% came from the British Isles, mostly Ireland. Within Europe, millions moved to cities seeking economic opportunities. During the 19th century, driven by the industrial economy, the percentage of Europeans living in cities rose from 10% in 1800 to 40% by 1900. What was life like for the new urban dwellers? The urban environment had changed pretty radically since the 18th century. The mid-19th century saw the great rebuilding of the great European capital cities. We've noted Napoleon III's Paris. There was also Victoria's London, Franz Josef's Vienna, and Wilhelmine Berlin. These cities were now filled with parks and green space, reflecting a greater recognition of the importance of fresh air and physical exercise, especially for people just up from the country who had no backyard. Napoleon III's Paris, redesigned by George Eugene Haussmann, saw wider streets which reduced congestion, produced sweeping vistas. Those wide streets also divided the respectable from poor areas and made it easier for troops to get in. This period saw the erection of great public buildings. Sometimes they expressed the power of the state. Government ministries, for example, the Great Range at Unter den Linden in Berlin, or along the Embankment and Whitehall in London. But new building also reflected the rise of personal leisure time. The 19th century was a great age for public museums. Now, the oldest public museum in the world is the Uffizi in Italy. It was established in 1591, its collections bequeathed to Florence in 1737. In Britain, the British Museum had been founded in 1753, but its great building in Great Russell Street was completed in 1847. The National Gallery of Art was founded in 1838. In France, the Louvre, originally a French royal palace, was confiscated at the French Revolution and opened as a public museum in 1793. Its great expansion took place under Napoleon III. In Netherlands, the Rijksmuseum Museum opened in 1798. And in Germany, the massive Berlin State Museum built up wonderful classical collections. The period saw the building of great opera houses and great department store. Harrods in London was founded in 1849 as a shop. Perhaps the world's first true department store was the Bon Marché in Paris, which was established in 1865. Street lighting changed the urban environment. For most of human history, cities were dark, and so they were dangerous. In the late 17th century, oil men and tallow chandlers were given contracts to erect what were basically large torches in some big city streets. It wasn't until early in the 19th century that gas lines were laid and streets could be lit by gas. These were replaced at the end of the century by electric lines and electric lights. Perhaps even more important was modern plumbing. Early modern streets had been made even more unpleasant by the fact that, in most European cities until the mid-19th century, the street itself was also a sewer. You've undoubtedly noticed those charming overhangs in medieval buildings, the shambles at York or medieval German towns. They existed so that people could throw out the night soil, that is, buckets of raw sewage, every morning. The possibilities for disease were rife, hence the cholera epidemics noted earlier. But early in the 19th century, great European cities began tackling sewage disposal. This became a source of national pride. In fact, people actually went on tours of the Paris sewers, you can imagine. Water filtration on a grand scale began to be seen as a civic responsibility. There was also, privately, an increasing emphasis on bathing as a way for the middle class to distinguish themselves from the dirty working class. By the end of the century, modern plumbing finally arrives, running water in taps, backyard outhouses, but the wealthiest had flush toilets in their own homes flowing into underground sewers. That wasn't the only thing flowing underground. People began to flow underground, too. Railways and interurban systems. By the late 19th century, Western Europe was crisscrossed with rail lines, making it possible to ship goods long distance by rail and travel into the country. The upper classes began to do this simply to enjoy tourism across Europe. Others used rail lines to migrate or took occasional day trips, as we've seen the Prussian army used the rail service very well. Within cities, rails revolutionized transportation. For most of European history, people walked or rode horses or rented sedan chairs or took their own coaches, if wealthy, to get around town. But all were hindered by narrow, muddy, filthy streets before about 1800. By the late 18th century, people were beginning to take hackney cabs and omnibuses pulled by horses. By the mid-19th century, the omnibuses were put on rails. This was faster, but it still led to massive problems from the horses themselves. They were often overworked, they couldn't pull uphill, and they produced tons more raw sewage in the streets. Things were even worse when a poor horse dropped dead, as often happened. It wasn't until 1880 that cable cars began to run in San Francisco, and that technology began to make its way across the Atlantic. By 1900, electric streetcars, electric underground trains, led to another massive public works project, and of course, this flow of people underneath the cities. Now, obviously, all of these economic and technological developments were going to have an effect on European politics and diplomacy. With the rise of nationalism and democracy, governments needed a plan, and that implied knowledge about their populations. The 19th century saw the first systematic censuses in Britain, in France, and the United States, enabling governments to plan taxation, conscription for war, prison building, and social welfare, including schools. In 1860, Sweden introduced the first income tax. That meant more government intrusion, but it also enabled government to pay for much of the above. Democracy, plus increasing professionalization of society, implied better education. Professionals were increasingly expected to have degrees. Still, by 1850, there were state school systems only in the Netherlands, Switzerland, and Sweden. Piedmont Savoy established a state system in 1847, which it extended to Italy in 1861. In France, anti-clerical Republicans wanted to wrest education from the church. Between 1879 and 81, the French Minister of Education, Jules Ferry, began a reform program. Each village was to have a school that was free, compulsory, secular, and coeducational. He established government teacher training colleges to set standards, and as a result, by 1901, 94% of men conscripted into the French army were literate. But few went on to secondary school or university education. In Britain, the Education Act of 1870 mandated the creation of public schools, and by the late 1880s, every child below the age of 10 was required to attend them. In Germany, from 1871, a national school system was established, and by 1900, that system produced a 99% literacy rate. In 1917, the corresponding figure in Russia was only 43%, in part because the Tsarist government actually forbade the education of peasants. Now, one thing that government statisticians and economists began to notice after 1870 was that for the first time in centuries, most industrial growth was not taking place in Great Britain. The British were slowing down. Take national income. Between 1820 and 1850, national income grew in Britain 3.5% a year. Between 1870 and 1914, that figure was reduced to 2.2%. Take steel. In 1870, Britain produced one half of the world's steel. By 1880, only a third. And by 1902, only a seventh of the world's steel. Take trade. In 1870, Britain controlled 41% of the world's trade. By 1914, that figure had sunk to 30%. Now please understand, British industry, trade, and wealth continue to grow. Britain still enjoyed a favorable balance of trade with most of the world. The British standard of living was still the highest in the world and rising. But other countries were beginning to catch up. Two in particular. Germany and the United States. The national income of Germany and the United States increased nearly 5% a year during this period. Remember, Britain is growing at just over 2%. Take steel. Germany surpassed Britain in steel production in 1893. By 1914, Germany made twice as much. Take trade. By 1914, Germany, followed closely by the U.S., handled nearly as much trade as the British. By 1914, the Germans were actually exporting more goods to Europe than the British were. Now, finally, you will note the number of life-changing inventions that had been made, first invented, in America, with which we began this lecture. Now, this apparent shift in Britain's economic position versus the rest of the world, especially Germany, helps, I think, to explain some of the international tensions described in the previous lecture. The search for colonies was at some level a search for new markets and cheaper source of raw materials in a competition that was getting ever hotter. So why did the British begin to decline relative to Germany and the United States? What is the reason for this? The obvious answer is, of course, that Britain's lead couldn't last forever. Other countries were bound to catch up sometime. But I would identify four factors that were actually retarding the British. The British made some errors that would have dire consequences for their economic future. First, education. British science education lagged. At schools like Eton, Harrow, and Rugby, at universities like Oxford, and to a lesser extent Cambridge, the sons of the British aristocracy had always been taught the Greek and especially the Latin classics. This was thought the education appropriate to future statesmen and diplomats. Given its snob value, it's the education that middle-class factory owners wanted for their sons as well. As a result, at the 19th century British university, there was actually a tremendous disdain for science majors. The slang word for them was stinks. This harked back to the old idea that true gentlemen did not get their hands dirty, whether with the soil or with chemicals. They didn't wear overalls and they didn't wear lab coats. Now, in fact, British theoretical science continued to excel. Trinity College, Cambridge claims more Nobel Prizes than France. But this did not translate so much into technological innovation as it had in the 18th century. Where British universities produced 200 engineers a year during this period, German universities were producing 3,000. The second entrepreneurial failure was a failure to reinvest in their factories. As we've noted repeatedly, the British were the first into the Industrial Revolution, and that head start gave them tremendous economic advantages, but it also saddled them with the oldest factories and the oldest technology. The Germans only started to build factories in earnest in the 1840s, so they benefited from more recent technology. But even after that, when technology changed, the Germans changed with it. In Germany, there was a close alliance among bankers and factory owners and government, and the result was a culture of reinvestment, of plowing profits back into the factory. The British very largely failed to embrace that culture. Why? Well, on one hand, just simply smug self-confidence, but also that upper-class disdain, not only for stinks, but for the dirty business of making money, had some influence on the middle class. Upper-middle-class factory owners seeking respectability didn't want to go back to the factory floor. They preferred to send their sons to Eton and Oxford and places like that than to send them to the factory. This, of course, continued to socialize them against science and business. They preferred to plow their profits into country estates rather than the factory itself, or to invest their money in overseas concerns or government bonds. And that brings me to the next reason for British decline, the third, an overprotected empire. Even as British products grew less marketable, the British could always dump them on their empire. Free trade existed within the empire, but it did not extend to other countries trading with Britain's imperial possessions, which means that the products from other countries, including Germany and America, faced high tariff barriers. Selling within their own empire to a captive British market meant, of course, that British industry did not have to innovate, did not have to become competitive. If you know anything about the history of the American television industry up to the 1960s, you'll understand what happened next. British telephones and vacuum cleaners fell behind their German and American counterparts in quality. If you're old enough, you may remember a running gag from the Beatles film Help, in which none of the inventions of the mad scientist for none of his schemes for world domination work because his British-made products always malfunction. So this became something of a cliche that British workmanship was poor. It also, of course, says something about the British view of scientists. The fourth reason for British decline is that they began to pour more and more of their national capital and energy into an arms race, first with France and then after 1871 with Germany. Now, Britain would win both of those races, but at the cost of immense national debt and falling further behind in terms of peacetime innovation. The trouble with weaponry is that it's often wasted money unless you actually use it. And there were few technical spin-offs to the kind of weaponry that the British and the Germans and the other great powers of Europe were building at this time. Which brings me to another long-term cause of the Great War, the arms race. This fact of an arms race had significance not just for Britain's industrial rivalry with Germany, but also for the long-term causes of the Great War. Now, historians debate as to whether arms races are necessarily causes for war. After all, there have been arms races that did not result in open conflict. The Anglo-French naval race of the 19th century. The Soviet-American nuclear buildup after World War II. But I would argue that building an arsenal does seem to make war more possible. You actually have the stuff with which to carry it out. And more thinkable. You have the constant temptation to use this stuff to find out if it actually works. Indeed, some arms races imply a certain amount of provocation, don't they? I mean, there you are, minding your own business, protected by your army and navy, and suddenly a neighbor or a new power begins to build up its army and navy. Well, why would they do that? Your intentions are entirely peaceful. You mean no harm to them. All you want is to enjoy the fruits of the empire you're exploiting and your own safety. It must be that they want to compromise that safety and take over that empire. So you, therefore, need to build up your army and navy and, therefore, produce more weapons. Of course, they begin to notice this and seeing the buildup. They come to the same conclusion about you. Why would you be building weapons unless you meant them harm? And thus, an arms race almost necessarily forces the racers to see each other as hostile. And that, I think, makes hostilities more likely. This is why Bismarck, in particular, never wanted there to be a German navy. Let me explain. In fact, there was no good reason for Britain and Germany to have an arms race at the end of the 19th century. Britain was a naval power whose traditional rival was France. As we have seen, the British had been supreme at sea since Nelson's victory at Trafalgar in 1805. Throughout the 19th century, Britain had pursued a policy of splendid isolation from Europe, concentrating on her empire and using the Royal Navy to protect it. Eventually, the British built a fleet bigger than any other two navies combined. Now, after France's defeat in 1871, there are no longer any major challenges to the British. Germany was a land power, whose traditional rivals were France and Russia. Prussia and then Germany had traditionally poured its wealth into its army. Bismarck was adamant that Germany should never build a large navy precisely because it would upset the British and cause them to look for allies. You catch the irony here? What's the one German naval vessel that nearly every person can name? It's the battleship Bismarck. But as so often happens in a monarchy, Germany stands changed because of one man. In 1888, Kaiser Friedrich, son of Germany's first Kaiser, Wilhelm I, died prematurely of throat cancer, bringing to the German throne Wilhelm II. The next year, the new Kaiser attended the annual British Naval Review at Spithead, off the Isle of Wight, as he had done many times before as a prince. Now, these reviews were intended to show off the power of the British fleet to foreign dignitaries. The most spectacular of them, and the best documented of these occasions, was held for Queen Victoria's Diamond Jubilee in 1897. And I think it gives us some idea of what Wilhelm must have seen 8 years before. As the Queen watched from shore, a total of 165 warships, 31 battleships, 42 cruisers, 30 destroyers, 20 torpedo boats, assorted support craft, arranged in five columns paraded past as their ships' bands played God Save the Queen, Heart of Oak, and of course, Rule Britannia, Britannia Rules the Waves. Britannia Rule the Waves. The procession took all day and stretched for 5 miles. Now, here was a physical manifestation of the power, the wealth, and the superiority that the British had been enjoying, well, since Blenheim in 1704. In the words of the Times, "Truly a marvelous pageant, and one which Britons may take pride in, knowing to be such as could be exhibited by no other nation, nor indeed by all of them put together." Perhaps most astonishingly, this was only half the fleet. The other half, another 170 warships, was on station, guarding the empire, enforcing the Pax Britannica. As I have said, this show was put on not for Queen Victoria's benefit, presumably she knew how many ships she had, but for that of an army of visiting dignitaries from across Europe and around the world. One can almost imagine young Wilhelm at that 1889 review, dressed in his splendid German naval uniform, watching through a spyglass, turning to his naval attaché and saying, "I want one of these." We don't know that he said that, but we do know that he said, "The trident must be in our fist." In 1890, Wilhelm dismissed the cautious Bismarck and began to build battleships. Now, in Wilhelm's defense, many contemporaries thought that he had every right to build battleships. In 1890, an American admiral, Alfred Thayer Mahan, published The Influence of Sea Power Upon History, arguing that Britain's economic superiority was a direct consequence of its naval superiority. The German admiral, Alfred von Tirpitz, argued that, as an industrial giant, Germany was now utterly dependent on raw materials from abroad, oil, rubber, cotton. Those trades could be threatened, in case of war, if Germany didn't have a navy to protect them. Once he was promoted to Secretary of State of the Imperial Naval Office, Tirpitz turned to the public for support. He gave lectures. He gave press conferences. He gave tours of naval facilities. He gave out study kits for schools. As a result, the 1897 Navy Bill, designed to double the size of the Imperial Navy, passed the Reichstag easily. So what was the British reaction to all this? What did they make of all this? At this point, it might be important to understand what kinds of weapons battleships were at the turn of the 20th century. They were first of all small by modern standards, about 10,000 tons, maybe 400 feet long. There are actually pleasure yachts in the world today that are bigger. They were armed with a bewildering array of guns of various calibers, maybe four big guns of 11 inches bore, 12 or 14 6-inch bore guns, and many miscellaneous smaller weapons. They were fairly slow. They could make maybe 12 knots. Both sides built scores of them. But in 1906, the British responded to the German challenge with a naval superweapon, a consummation of all the destructive power of which the Second Industrial Revolution was capable, HMS Dreadnought. She weighed in at 18,000 tons. She was 520 feet long, 82 feet wide. She carried 12 12-inch bore guns, each with a range of 20 miles. Her armor plate was 11 inches thick. Her engines generated 23,000 horsepower and could achieve a maximum speed of 18 knots. Now, in every way, this was a great advance on the slower, less well-armed and armored ships, which had passed for battleships up to this point. But that meant that the Dreadnought was a huge gamble. It instantly rendered the entire German battle fleet obsolete. But of course, it did the same for the British, didn't it? Everyone would have to start from scratch. Would the naval race start anew, or had the British just ended it with their superweapon? Well, I think you can probably guess the answer. The correct answer was, of course, A. Dreadnought battleships became the ICBMs of their day. Naval power and national wealth henceforth would be measured in the number of dreadnoughts one had. No country could be taken seriously without having at least one. The British and the Germans would have many more at $2 million a pop. By 1914, the British had built 21 dreadnought battleships to form the Grand Fleet. The Germans had built 14, forming the backbone of the High Seas Fleet. Both navies now trained incessantly for what the Germans referred to as Der Tag, the day, a second Trafalgar in which one side or the other would establish naval supremacy once and for all. In fact, by 1914, the great powers were stockpiling not just battleships, but ammunition, artillery, rifles, machine guns, and men. Every single one of them but Britain had implemented conscription, a draft, in order to build vast armies as well. In the words of the British Foreign Secretary, Sir Edward Grey, "The great nations of Europe are raising enormous revenues in order to kill each other." Indeed, as the 20th century dawned, it began to seem inevitable that nearly a century after the Congress of Vienna, Europe would once again explode into war over some foreign colony, over trading rights, aided and abetted by the wealth of empire and the weaponry forged by the Second Industrial Revolution. There was only one hope to prevent the explosion and preserve the peace in Europe, a system of alliances originally established by Otto von Bismarck for this purpose. Little did he know that, after his death, thanks to the machinations of his Kaiser, that alliance system would provide the final spark necessary to light the fuse.